Okay, so I'm going to get started. And then like I said, just make sure that you return this to Adam by the end of the class. And then he will summarize the results and send them to me, then I'll send it to the class. Okay, so what I am going to do is continue where we left off. Before I start, are there questions? Yes.
Mm-hmm. I get sound, it means logically valid, but I'm not sure.
Complete means that everything that is entailed is also derived. Okay, so the entailment is defined really in terms of model theory. Okay, what that says is if KB is this set of worlds, alpha is this set of worlds, then KB entails alpha. That means if every world where the knowledge base is true, the alpha is true, then alpha is entailed. This is the gold standard. Ultimately, this is how entailment is defined. Okay? But, and in fact, to compute this, sometimes for propositional logic, you can write truth tables and enumerate. It already becomes quite hard. As I told you, in fact, even in propositional logic, suppose I have P1 to P10,000. Propositions, okay, and then I have a huge number of, and so 10,000 propositions, and I have a huge number of clauses, okay, or facts. It so happens that the 990th one says P100 implies P157, and then 2955th clause says P100. Okay, so there's a huge big knowledge base, and I'm asking, does this entail P100? I'm sorry, P157. Okay, and you know, and I know, yes. Yeah, you know, and I know that P157 is entailed, and in fact, you can see conceptually that if you were to evaluate all the worlds, okay, where the knowledge base is true, you would be able to show that in every world where knowledge base is true, P157 is actually true. Except the number of worlds you would be forced to evaluate would be 2 power 10,000. Okay, it's a pretty painful thing, right? But really, all I want to do is just be able to put these two obvious sentences together and derive something. Okay, so that's why instead of model theory, you also have proof theory. Proof theory is basically inferences. They take syntactic forms of the sentences and allow you to write new sentences. Okay, so inference rule you know is modus ponens, which says if you have something like A implies B and A is true, you just get to write B is true. This is an inference rule. So this, let's say this is modus ponens inference rule. So then by modus ponens, you can derive B. The question, of course, is since this is the gold standard, whatever you're doing here better be in sync with this. Okay? If this guy winds up deriving things that are not actually entailed, then it's an unsound inference. If this guy is unable to derive things that are entailed, then it is incomplete. And modus ponens by itself will not be able to derive everything that's entailed. For example, as I said, if you know A or B and A implies C and B implies C in your knowledge base, then using just the truth table method, you can clearly show that C is true. But just using the inference rule, you cannot show that C is true unless you use resolution. Just using the modus ponens inference rule, you'll be unable to show that C is true. So that's why modus ponens is incomplete. To actually prove that something is complete, you need to write an inductive argument. You have to essentially, you know, the textbook actually provides an inductive argument for the completeness of resolution theorem proving. It's easier to prove that something is not complete because all you need to do is provide one counterexample. Okay, the one thing that I didn't do in the class is to actually prove that resolution is complete, and you know that goes by induction on the size of the sentences. Okay, so that's the difference. So proof theory is the shortcut that you're using to make your life simple, and this kind of a theory can easily look at, even though the knowledge base is so big, it can pick these two sentences and write P157, like, you know, right away. Whereas if you had to do it using model theory, you would have spent your lifetime writing the entire, you know, truth table. Okay, so this is the gold standard. Remember that this is the gold standard. And to understand what, you know, when you come up with a new logic, you always talk about what's the model theory for the logic first. That's providing the semantics. Then all the inference rules would then be said to be in sync. I mean, if they actually do not derive anything that's not entailed, then they are found. And if they derive everything that is entailed, then they are complete. And if they have both those properties, then essentially this is the same as this.
So in that case, A implies B and A are your knowledge base?
Yes.
And they're both, the fact that true is your knowledge base.
Yeah. See, if something is in your knowledge base, that means you believe that's to be true for the world you live in. That's the assumption. So a constraint in your knowledge, every sentence that you know about your world reduces the number of possible worlds that are consistent with what you think you are living in. Okay? Other questions? Okay. For those of you who came late, make sure that you fill that midterm feedback form that you should have in front of you. I'll pick it up from the in the front of the class and give it to the guy at the corner by the end of the class, and then he would summarize, and everything is anonymous. You would not have to worry about your handwriting being recognized. Okay. One other thing I mentioned in the email after the last class is the homework is now actually due next Thursday, and I added an extra question. So that sort of completes, you know, gets the homework up to the logic part, you know, proposition logic part. And then, so that you'll be ready for the midterm. Okay. Project is still Tuesday. Okay. So one thing I was mentioning last class was that we talked about resolution. We talked about a special case of resolution called unit resolution. And then I said unit resolution is actually quite useful, and that when you are writing, when you are solving SAT problems, where SAT is nothing but Boolean constraint satisfaction problem, then the thing that you do in solving SAT problems, you can of course try to do forward checking for SAT problems too, because it's just nothing but Boolean CSP, except since there are only two values, there isn't that much of a use of directly doing just forward checking. It turns out that if you run unit propagation to completion, so that you no longer can do any more unit resolutions, and then pick the next variable, that is a great equivalent. It's sort of doing constraint propagation. Do a decision, propagate the consequences of that decision as far as you can, just using cheap inference, which is unit propagation. Okay? And then pick the next variable. If you do that, that winds up being a very, very powerful idea for solving propositional satisfiability problems. And this is actually, you know, invented in the year I was born, DPLL, 1962 time frame, where Putnam, Davis, and Lodgman and Loveland then added a couple of things afterwards. And this is one of the ACM papers. This is the Journal of ACM papers, you know, one of the oldest ones. And this is basically solving Boolean satisfiability problems using systematic search. And if you look at this, this is actually just a special case of the CSP search strategies that we looked at last time. Okay, and I want to get you through this algorithm by showing you an example, A, because, you know, in fact, you can see how effective unit propagation can be. Okay, and then B, because I also want to use this to point out that solving SAT problems is like a huge cottage industry right now, and because many, many people can in all disparate areas, like either in electrical engineering or in computer science or in economics, can oftentimes compile their problems into a SAT problem. Okay? And so if you just compile your problem into the SAT problem, then if there's a very fast SAT solver, then you're done. This is not surprising because right now you're compiling all your problems into Intel instruction set, right? Most of you at any rate. I mean, now that, you know, even Apple has become Intel, then everybody is converting all their problems into Intel instruction set. And then there happens to be a fast machine which can solve the Intel instruction set, and then so that's how you're solving your problems. We can now convert it into a slightly higher level, which is SAT instruction set, which is SAT solving. Okay. In general, this idea of converting some, you know, a combinatorial problem into some substrate is a very powerful idea. And those of you who know linear programming and integer programming from operations research side, the whole entire, you know, a large part of operations research is taking your problem, converting it into integer linear programming problem. And then there are companies which make these solvers which are, you know, improving every year, and then you just solve it on them. Okay, so when we are looking at SAT, we are basically sort of talking about things like writing a faster linear programming, integer programming solving. Okay, so let me look at, unlike integer linear programming, where it doesn't look like there is that much theoretical advances every year. In fact, there's like this one company called iLog, and everything depends on iLog coming up with the next version. And you pay another $10,000 and they'll give you the next version. This is like Windows, right? And then you just try to use that. There's not that much great theoretical advances that are coming in the integer linear programming community every year. Whereas SAT, I'll show you in a minute, that there is this very vibrant community which is coming up with faster and faster and faster SAT solvers every year. And there doesn't seem to be any end in sight. Okay, so if there's one thing you can learn, which is at least try to figure out how to compile the problem that you care about into SAT, and then you can go to sleep, because every year they will come up with a free solver that solves this even faster. That's not bad, right? Again, this is the Tom Sawyer way of getting your things done. You know, just do it into somebody else, and somebody else solves the problem for you freely. Okay, so DPLL, one example. So remember, it's a Boolean CSP. I write all my constraints in the clausal form. Okay, just clauses where the comma means it's a disjunction. Okay, consider this little example now. My constraint, my variables are P, S, U, Q, R, T, right? Those are the only variables I have. And these are the constraints. Okay, you can think of them as clauses, but they're also constraints. Okay, in essence, if you don't have any clauses, then can you give me a satisfying assignment? Yeah. Pretty much any truth falsity assignment is a satisfying assignment. As I keep increasing the clauses, then I'm cutting down some of the assignments. And your point, your, when I give you these constraints, then your work, your basically your job is to find me at least one model, that is one assignment of truth falsity variables to P, Q, R, S, T, U, that will satisfy all the clauses. That's the simplest SAT problem. Okay? There are variations of SAT problems such as model counting. That is, tell me all the models for this problem, which you can do for propositional logic because there are only a finite number of assignments. Okay? And when you start counting models, that would be useful for probabilistic reasoning, which actually means that even when you go into probabilistic reasoning, you can still convert everything you know into a SAT problem, and you know, counting SAT solvers can solve it fast for you. Okay, so it's a lot of interesting reasons to learn this, and what's interesting is you are very close to understanding all of it, right, because you just know CSP. Okay, so what do you do in CSP? In a systematic CSP solver, you pick a variable, give it a value, you know, give it truth and falsity values. Okay, and now of course, the question is how do I pick? You know, there is this most constrained variable, least constraining value business. Now, for now, let's assume that I don't have a variable picking heuristic. Just pick something right now, for now. Okay? Let's say I pick P. Okay? Now if I pick P, I can set P equal to true in one branch, P equal to false in another branch. That's all I get to do. Okay? And so I can set P equal to true and call myself recursively again. In fact, if you go back to this, this whole thing is written as a recursive procedure. All it does is it picks a variable, gives it a value, you know, truth value, recurses. If it succeeds, it doesn't have to do anything. If not, the recursion comes unwinding all the way up, then you try the false value. So everything just by recursion. Okay? So I pick P, I set P equal to true, not because I think that's the right answer, but I'll just try one, true first and then false, let's say. So I pick P equal to true. Now the interesting thing, of course, is I have to do some constraint propagation. I used to do forward checking in CSP solvers, right? Now, instead of that, I would just run unit propagation. What is unit propagation? Basically running unit resolution until I run out of unit clauses to resolve with. The interesting thing is when I run one unit resolution, I may get an extra unit clause which can then be combined with something else. Okay? See what happens in this simple example. It's pretty interesting because if I start doing unit propagation, now suppose when you set P equal to true, that essentially means in this branch, P is a clause now. Right? P equal to true means P is a clause. Okay? So what I can do, first of all, since P is a clause, then this clause is actually satisfied. If P is already true, P is, you know, this clause is satisfied. If this is satisfied, as far as this branch is concerned, this is not a constraint anymore for this branch. So I can ignore it. Okay, now I will put P and this not P, Q. And if I resolve that, what do I get? P resolve with not P or Q. If you just look at it, P resolve with not P or Q, I get Q. Yeah? So I basically, since I get Q, that means I have to set Q equal to true. I cannot set Q equal to false. If I set Q equal to false, that means Q is actually entailed and I'm trying to assume not of Q, that means this branch will die right away. Okay? So now I'm going to set Q equal to true. Now furthermore, since Q is equal to true, this clause is satisfied. Why? Since P is true, this is basically false. I mean, P is true and Q is true, not P or Q. Okay? This is false or true. It's true. So the clause is true. Clause is satisfied. So I can remove that clause from consideration as far as I'm concerned for this branch. Okay? Now, furthermore, since Q is true, Q or not S or T is true. In any clause, if one of the, because each clause is a disjunction, in any clause, if one of the literals is true, then the entire clause is true. Yes? Okay? So I can remove Q and not S and T. Now I can also, one more, see here I'm just removing essentially to make things simple. These are the only constraints in this branch, these are the only constraints I have to really worry about because the rest are already holding. Okay? And now since Q is true is a clause and I have not Q or R, I can do one more resolution, one more unit resolution. And notice that previously, until I did this, I don't have Q as a clause. So I'm basically doing a cascading set of resolutions. Okay, I keep doing it until I can't do any more unit resolutions. That's the basic idea. Unlike forward checking, which just goes one direction. Okay, so now Q and not Q are R, and derived, basically you can get derived R, so you set R equal to true. Okay? And at this point, not Q or R is satisfied, you can remove that. Okay? Now, also, since R is true, R and R or S is satisfied. So you can remove that too. Okay? So at this point, suddenly you find just because you said P equal to true, then I only am left with two constraints, not S or T and not S or U. So in fact, the minimum you need to do is just provide some of these three variables values and the rest don't matter. Every valuation for those other variables would be part of a model. That's the nice thing. Okay, so this is already great. I only have three variables left. I want to be even more lazy. I realize that the only two clauses left, not S or T and not S or U, S is a pure literal. That means in the only clauses that are left, S is appearing in the negation, you know, only one polarity, with one polarity. It's always negative. Okay? So it turns out that in such cases, you can go ahead and eliminate the pure literal by assuming that pure literal is equal to true, and you would not lose completeness. If there was a model for the original CSP problem, then after eliminating the pure literal, you still have a model. If it didn't have, then you don't have. Okay? So, pure literal, not S or T, not S or U, so I'll just go ahead and assume not S is true. In this case, this is just an extra trick where in all the remaining clauses, S occurs negative, so let's go ahead and set not S equal to true. That means S equal to false. What happened now? Normally, at this point, there may have been a whole number of clauses left, except that the only clauses where S is occurring, S is negative. In which case, those two clauses would have gone, and any more clauses may still be left. In this problem, these are the only clauses. So the moment you said not S equal to true, then this is gone, and this is gone. So there are no more constraints left. So just based on the decisions you made, P equal to true, Q equal to true, R equal to true, S equal to false, you got a model. Okay? P equal to true, Q equal to true, R equal to true, S equal to false. Now you might ask, hey, how can you have a model? You are supposed to tell me every variable's value. Okay? What variables didn't I tell you values of? T and U, for example. The reason I didn't tell you those values is because I don't care. You can make them false or true and nothing changes. Okay, so in fact, not only did I give you, so how many variables are there? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, right? 6, 7, 7 variables, right? So there are 7 variables, and I only gave 4 variables value. That means the other 3 can take either true or false, so there are actually, this corresponds to 8 models. In one fell swoop, I got you 8 models, not just one. But all you needed is just one model. Okay? Now, basically, when you run unit propagation to completion, sometimes it can take multiple iterations. But all we know is that you can always run unit propagation to completion in time that is polynomial on the size of the database, size of the list, the set of clauses. It looks like it's a painful thing to do, but it turns out that it actually works very well. Okay? Now, as I said, pure literal elimination, you know, the only thing that you care is in this branch, originally S was not pure. Originally, if you look at all the clauses, S was not pure because S is appearing both positive and negative. But by the time you came here, it was pure. Only negative was left. And at any point, you only care about the CSP that is left, obviously. Okay? And the other interesting thing about pure literal elimination that I said is, so, you know, a box has a box now. That if there is a model, pure literal elimination will find a model. Pure literal elimination may not find all possible models. For example, there may have been models for this problem where S is true, but you won't find them. Do you understand what I'm saying? So as long as your interest is only finding a model, pure literal elimination is a completeness preserving heuristic. If on the other hand, your interest is counting the models, are finding the model with a certain property, then it's no longer completeness preserving. Okay? And then I'll go back to the top question, pick P. How do I pick P? Well, I can do whatever has the least number of values left, right? But then for a Boolean CSP, it's going to be one of three values, zero values, two values, or one value. So it's not really going to do a huge amount of distinction between variables. When it is zero, right, you can actually, there is nothing left. You actually die on that branch. If it is one, you just go ahead and commit to that value. If it is two, that's what most of the variables are anyway. So for Boolean CSP, going with the most constrained variable as the variable with the smallest domain, it still works, but it's not as effective. But since you know who is the workhorse in this procedure, the unit propagation, right? why don't I do the following? For every variable here, I consider trying to make a decision of branching on that variable, see how much unit propagation I can do. Okay, in particular, when the unit propagation is done, like remember, when the unit propagation is done, the variable, the after this unit propagation is done, let's say, right, just with P and Q, until here, I already have only this much left, only these many constraints are left. So if I were to pick P, on the true side, I will only have 4 constraints left. On the false side, I can compute how many constraints are left using the unit propagation up front. Then I try it for Q, then I try it for R, then I try it for S, then I try it for T, then I try it for U, and then decide which of them seems to get to the largest decrease in the number of clauses left. And then use that reasoning to figure out what is the next variable to pick. This idea looks so far out. It's just as far out as the pattern database heuristic. You would think heuristics are supposed to get done very fast, right? Here you're spending a huge, huge amount of time in trying to decide what's the next variable to pick. You're doing almost as much reasoning as a pattern database heuristic does. Not surprisingly, while the DPLL idea has been found in 1962, the idea that I just pointed out, that is, eagerly go ahead and do unit resolution on every possible variable and see which variable will give the maximum unit resolution. That means the smallest remaining thing, and then pick that and actually commit to it. This idea nobody ever thought would make sense. And so it wasn't tried until 1998 or 99. And that gave rise to a solver called SAT-Z solver. Okay, which everybody expects won't work, but it actually works. It works really fast. Okay, so you actually learned a lot of things here. One, you see how unit propagation is being used in the normal DPLL procedure. And secondly, you can also use this to pick the variables. You know, by being really eager about which variable to pick next, you still actually wind up doing quite well. Okay, what SAT-Z does is it doesn't really look at all variables, but it looks at a huge number of variables, a huge number of subsets of variables, and then picks among them using which one will lead to maximum unit propagation. Okay, so now let's give you an idea of where the SAT solvers. I said SAT solving has been like a big cottage industry, and things are, you know, happening every year as we speak. So here is a little timetable. So DPLL was back in 1960s. Okay, actually DP was 1960s. By the way, the Putnam of Davis Putnam, how many of you know about a Putnam mathematics competition? Okay, so Putnam mathematics competition is the main mathematics Olympiad in US for university students, and that's the same Putnam. Okay, so Davis Putnam procedure was there, and then Lodgman and Loveland added a couple of things, and so it's become DPLL procedure. Okay, and then it has been around for a long time. And then until around 1994, people used to assume that SAT problems are hard to solve. You know, we do have DPLL, which is systematic, and it'll solve okay, but, you know, large scale problems, if you have, you know, thousands of clauses and hundreds of variables, you can take forever. A, because the computers are slow, and B, because the algorithm is slow. Okay? And then, in fact, in 1994, they looked at GSAT, which is basically the WalkSAT procedure that we discussed a couple of classes back, where you do local search. You guess an entire complete assignment and see if it's already holding. That means if it satisfies all the constraints. If not, then randomly pick a variable that is taking part in one of the violated constraints and flip its value. Right? That's what it was being done. And in fact, the GSAT basically says take a violated constraint and consider flipping the values of each of the variables in that constraint. And if you flip any variable, then that constraint will become normal. I mean, it will become satisfied. The question, of course, is which one to flip, and you will flip that one which will reduce the number of violated clauses the most. That's what we talked about. This is a local search algorithm. And when they did GSAT, which is a hill climbing search for SAT, suddenly they found that, in fact, most of the SAT problems are easy. which is where this whole entire phase transition theory had to be invented, because people were worried that maybe they were hallucinating, that SAT is actually hard, but it's not really hard, because everything that GSAT was solving wound up being very fast. I mean, it was able to solve most instances very fast. And then came that phase transition idea, which people actually explained to themselves that, look, in fact, there are hard problems. We are not hallucinating, except those hard problems are only in a narrow band. And if you generate random problems, the overwhelming chance is that your problem won't be in that narrow band. Even though there are infinite number of problems in that narrow band, you know, it's just a narrow band. So there are other infinite number of problems outside and which you are more likely to generate them. Okay? So when they generated that particular middle part, then GSAT started doing not as well. And furthermore, one problem with GSAT has always been that if the best algorithm you have is a local search algorithm, then you can't actually use it to show unsatisfiability. You can use it to show satisfiability, but you can't use it to show unsatisfiability. And showing unsatisfiability is just as important. If you want to check if your knowledge base is inconsistent, you need to show unsatisfiability. If you want to check entailment using truth tables, you have to show unsatisfiability. Okay? If you want to count models, you have to show, basically, you need systematic search again. So you used to be systematic before, and then for a bunch of time around 1994, everything was non-systematic or local search procedures. That was winning. Okay? And 1997 came SAT-Z, which is the idea that I just explained to you, which nobody wanted to touch with a 10-foot pole, because everybody was happy that local search was working so much, we don't need to teach anybody any systematic search methods anymore. And then these guys came and tried something that looked so stupid, you know, that everybody avoided trying, and yet it actually worked extremely well. And so SAT-Z saw, you know, was much, much, much faster than GSAT. In fact, it was, if it's even as fast as GSAT, you already love it, because it's fast and systematic. Turned out that it was actually quite competitive with respect to GSAT. Then you almost thought, wow, you know, there's nothing much going to happen. You know, SAT is solved now. And then 1998 to 99, they did this RELSAT, which is essentially dependency-directed backtracking, which basically, when there is a failure, rather than go chronologically back to the most recent assignment you did, it tries to figure out which is the assignment that you should go back to that actually took part in the failure. We talked about it, you know, lightly, but, you know, if you throw that idea in, then you get RELSAT, relevance SAT, and that was the queen or the king for a couple of years. Okay, and then came this 1 year where, you know, I and my wife keep our marriage intact by not talking to each other about work. You know, she's in electrical engineering, I'm in computer science, and one day suddenly I was looking at her proceedings of DAC, Design Automation Conference, and I see this SAT solver paper, okay, which was the CHAP SAT solver. There's a bunch of engineers sitting in engineering department, you know, electrical engineering in Princeton, came up with, like, basically a really nicely engineered version of RELSAT plus a whole bunch of extra tricks. And that was the king, emperor for a while, okay? Because SAT was interesting not just for us, computer science people, but also for EE people, because if they want to show certain properties for Boolean circuits, you want to write it as SAT problems. Okay, so these guys actually were interested in circuit verification. Kind of a community. And then suddenly, CHAP was the big game in town. And then that looked like, you know, computer scientists lost out. And then suddenly, and by 2004, somebody else came about with Siege. I no longer even keep track of what are all the greatest new things they're doing. All you know is every year there's a new solver which is so much faster. In fact, one of the smart ideas that is actually being used is using DNF version rather than the CNF version for the clauses. I won't go into too much detail, but you can go back and look at it. Okay, so if you want to find out where the current queens and kings are in SAT, that's the page to go to, satcompetition.org. They hold a competition every 2 years to compare free SAT solvers. And then, you know, notice that every year it's a different guy. And most of them are systematic solvers. So the age of, you know, local search solvers has sort of come to an end. And you can do systematic search and do very fast SAT solving. And it's so fast that we are talking about close to millions of clauses and tens of thousands of variables. Just reading the database should take a huge amount of time. And yet these solvers just get through them like there's no tomorrow. I mean, basically in a couple of minutes and so on. Okay? So now why is this interesting? As I said, many, many problems can be compiled down to SAT. And OR guys are very worried now because they suddenly realize that, you know, a bunch of people in engineering and computer science are able to come up with solvers that are so much faster and they're increasing every year. Okay? What's going on with SAT is sort of similar to what went on with RISC. What's RISC? Reduced instruction set computing. Okay? For a while in computing, people used to do CISC, complex instructions, okay, highly micro-programmed instructions. At the time of Lisp machines, for a while, they would have machines which have direct hardware support for Lisp. You just came too late, okay? And you just have to pay for two Texas Instruments, something like, you know, $50,000-$60,000, and you'll get one of these. And they were way ahead of their time. You might laugh, but they're way ahead of their time. You know, everything you take for granted now in all these new languages were there 20, 30 years back in Lisp. Okay? And when Lisp machines were going on, in fact, everybody assumed that's the aim, you know, the direction of the future, because these complex microprogrammed architectures for the specific languages would take over. And yet, what happened essentially is when Sun started working on reduced instruction set computing, and they were able to, because the instruction set was small enough, they can spend real time in improving the speed. Okay, and so what they were able to do in improving the speed of the RISC architecture was faster than what people were able to do in Lisp machines, because they're too complex to, you know, optimize at the hardware level. So sooner or later, there came a time when essentially the RISC processors were going, you know, multi-gigahertz as frequencies, and so basically there was no hope for the RISC processor. SAT is sort of like that. You know, if you think of even CSP versus SAT, CSP has all sorts of interesting issues. You can have binary versus non-binary constraints. You can have real-valued versus non-real-valued constraints. SAT says, you know, I'm going to keep it very simple. I'm just going to look at propositions and clauses over the propositions. Makes the problem very simple. And then people, large number of people can just get into the problem and start, who have no interest in neither electrical engineering nor computer science, get into it and start, you know, coming up with faster and faster solvers. And everybody benefits. Okay? So this is a sort of a sociology of research too, because if you want other people to solve your problem, make the problem easy to understand. And if it takes 10,000 pages to understand your problem, nobody is going to solve it. Okay? So SAT is extremely, I mean, if you must bet your horse, you know, bet on a combinatorial substrate, I would say bet on SAT. There are variations of SAT that are, you know, being tried, etc. SAT, in fact, you can see SAT plus on SAT means this is the track where they consider both satisfiable and unsatisfiable instances. Okay, this one is a track where only satisfiable instances are given. Notice that clearly there is no hope for local search strategies in this one. Not as much hope. There is some quite a good hope in the second track. And the third one is unsat, which is all unsatisfiable CSPs. And local search strategies might as well just pack up and leave at that point, because they can never tell that there is no solution. Okay, and then there are all sorts of other things that they have tried, you know, it's not here, called quantified Boolean formulas, MaxSat, which is where for each of these clauses, you give a number saying if you violate the clause, this is the penalty. And then you are supposed to find the assignment that has the lowest penalty. This much you know. If you are trying to solve MaxSat problem, this will go. Pure literal elimination can be used if you are solving MaxSat problem. because it may well be that S being true will lead to eventually the cheapest model, even though there are a huge number of models with S being false. Okay? Okay, so that's a big, but I think hopefully very important diversion. You know, it's connecting directly to things that are happening. So I guess if, you know, I forgot to show this, but in 2007, there was a competition in that, and then the next one is 2009, which is this year. You know, you can start writing your SAT solvers and go to Swansea in, I think, UK, where, you know, you get to show off your SAT solver. And then you can actually just run some of these SAT solvers. Most of these, because it's free, right, you can actually download it and try it, and they are amazingly fast. And I'll show you some later on when we get to planning. I'll show you that rather than write your own planning search program, you can convert planning into a SAT, and then these guys will solve it much faster. In fact, there's this one guy called Henry Couch, and all he did was 1 year he just converted SAT, planning into SAT, and then he just bought an easy chair and sat on it. And then every other year he will be winning the competition again because somebody else came up with an even faster solver. And the rest of us are coming up with faster and faster search algorithms for planning, and we are not getting too far because he has too many people working for him, right? So it's good to know what to, you know, what to bet on. Anyway, I mean, I did give you a simplified picture, but you know, it's a very important thing to know about this work here. Okay, any questions? So if not, then what I'm going to do now is slowly go from propositional logic to probabilistic propositional logic. And what we want to really understand in today's class is, why do we need anything else? We're so happy with this stuff. Why don't we, you know, just get on with this alone? And so first of all, let's review propositional logic. To solve problems using propositional logic, you need to write what you know as propositional formulas. Okay, and then theorem proving will then tell you whether a given new sentence will hold, which is entailed, given what you already know. Okay, now what kinds of queries? You already saw one query, which is simple: is the sentence S entailed by my knowledge base? By my knowledge base. That's, you know, I want to see whether a certain sentence is entailed. That's a normal theorem proving. But it turns out that you could also have other queries. You know, somebody just gave me an extra fact, I threw it into my knowledge base, I'm having this little worry that maybe it's inconsistent with things that I know. Okay, can I be sure that what I'm throwing into my knowledge base, I suddenly woke up one day, I want to check if my knowledge base is still consistent. Is there even a single word that is consistent with what I know? Right? That is basically knowledge base consistency checking, which is to show that the knowledge base has a model. Are to show that you cannot derive an empty class just by doing resolution on your knowledge base. Okay? A third kind of thing is, I'm about to learn a new fact. I'm going to put it into my knowledge base, but before I put it into my knowledge base, I want to make sure, is this going to cause trouble later on? Okay? Is this fact that I am adding to my knowledge base, is it consistent with what I know? Okay, this happens to you all the time. You learn something about Bohr atomic model, Rutherford atomic model, or even before the Chadwick atomic model, and then when you learn the next atomic model, then you have to figure out, is it consistent with what I know? Of course not. So some things have to go. Right, for example, I really love the Chadwick atomic model where, you know, nucleus is a like huge big pizza dough, and then you throw in, you know, electrons into the middle. You know, by pushing it in, like, you know, pepperoni or something. Okay? But when that is wrong, so when you throw in the Rutherford model where, you know, you actually have electrons circling around nucleus, clearly if you throw that as well as Chadwick model into what you know, your head is going to blow up because there is inconsistency. Okay? So something has to be removed. The question is, what are you going to remove? And furthermore, what I'm adding, is it consistent or not with my knowledge base? And if it's inconsistent, and if I still want to add this, then I have to remove something that I know before, because that must have been wrong. This is a very useful thing to do. And the way we do it normally, and in fact the way logic would ask you to do it, is when you're trying to add F to the knowledge base, check if not S is already entailed. If not S is not already entailed, then you are allowed to add S to it. Right? If you don't know already the opposite of what you are about to add, then you can add what you are just about to add. Now, if not S is entailed and you still want to add S, then you can do one of two things. One, I just add it and say to heck with it. Now onwards, I'll prove every theorem because now I'm false, right? My knowledge base is false. So you ask me any theorem, I'll say yes, because everything follows from false. Or you want to get back to consistency. To get back to consistency, what you now have to do is consider every proof structure for not S, every way of deriving not S, and then cut it somewhere so that it won't go through. Do you understand what I'm saying? When you are able to derive not S, maybe, you know, facts F1, F15, F19, F30, you know, 3050, these are all used to derive not S. You don't want to be able to derive not S. So you have to remove one of these guys to stop this proof. And then to stop another proof, again, you have to do the same thing. Okay? In essence, that's how we learn in normal world. When we, you know, when we have wrong assumptions about the world, and something that you are forced to add to your head should not break your head, then you need to undo, you need to remove something that you learned before. Of course, this analogy is unfortunately only partly true for humans, because humans are extremely good at not letting their right hand know what their left hand is doing. Okay, we will learn. In fact, there's a philosophy book that I have for undergraduate philosophy majors starts with the following paragraph. He says, in the middle of India, there's this professor who is teaching in an astronomy class to his students exactly how eclipses occur, how solar eclipse occurs. Okay? And then he will tell them how to compute, you know, the time when this will occur and how long it will take place and so on. And having completed that discussion, then he goes home and takes a shower, head shower, because in Hindu mythology, eclipse actually occurs because one particular monster eats up sun. Okay? And so in that case, then basically you are feeling very sorry for the sun and you're supposed to take a shower. Okay, I know Hinduism, so I can tell you that. I'm sure you have exactly the same kinds of things in every possible religion. Now, this professor should have had his or her head explode because of all these inconsistencies, but obviously it's not, right? Because they kept these two things separate, and they are able to reason with this separately from reason with this. So we actually live with inconsistent information all the time, but normal monotonic logic knowledge bases have to deal with the inconsistency by removing the structure that will lead you, so the ways in which you can prove the negation of what you're trying to add. Okay, but all these kinds of reasonings you can do with propositional logic. You thought only this, but now actually all of these. By the way, this idea is called theory revision. So you're revising the theory based on new things that you learned. Okay, pretty beautiful thing, and we do it all the time. Okay, now what can't you do? So, for example, if I have the following example, some guy called Pearl lives in Los Angeles. It's a high crime area. Pearl installed a burglar alarm. He asked his neighbors John and Mary to call him if they hear the alarm. This way he can come home if there is a burglary. Okay, Los Angeles also is earthquake prone, and the alarm goes off when there is an earthquake too. Okay, this is what I know about the world. Can I write this in propositional logic? Yeah. So here, burglary implies alarm, earthquakes implies alarm, alarm implies John calls, alarm implies Mary calls. That's what I know about the world. Okay, now if there is a burglary, will Mary call? I want to ask, if this is the knowledge base and, I'm sorry, this should be B. If this is a knowledge base and B actually happens, that means burglary actually happens, will it entail that Mary will call? You can do it as a theorem proving. Okay? And similarly, if there is an earthquake, will Mary call? You can check that too. Okay? If Mary didn't call, is it possible that burglary occurred? So if I know this whole thing, plus I know that Mary didn't call, can I still believe that burglary didn't occur? I can believe it if in fact these two together don't already show burglary occurred. That's a consistency check, right? So you get to believe things as long as it doesn't cause inconsistency in your beliefs. Okay? These things you can do with just propositional logic. Looks like it's a pretty good deal, right? What can't you do? That's a Pearl who lives in Los Angeles that may or may not exist. Here is a Pearl who lives in a real Los Angeles where the following things also are true. Okay? In real world, burglars can sometimes disable alarms. Now, if you don't know this, you haven't seen enough movies. Okay? Some earthquakes may be too slight to cause an alarm to go off. Even in Los Angeles, burglaries are more likely than earthquakes. We all assume that, you know, Arizona is going to have a beachfront property very soon, but still very soon is in terms of millions of years probably, hopefully. Okay? John and Mary both have their own lives and may not always call when the alarm goes off. Okay? Between John and Mary, John is more of a slacker than Mary. Johns are always slackers than Marys, right? That's the usual thing. John and Mary may call even without alarm going up. After all, they are Pearl's friends. They might just call, right? And as soon as they call and the caller ID says John is calling, Pearl shouldn't just jump into the car and go. It could be to say, hey, how are you doing? Right? These are all true. This is true of the world you live in. Can I write this stuff? In the propositional logic. Okay? And furthermore, this is the kind of case, apart from these questions, I might also want to ask these questions. John already called. If Mary also calls, is it more likely that the burglary occurred? In propositional logic, either you're true or you're false. If you're true once, it doesn't matter making it even more true. There is only one true. But that's not the way you live the world. If John called, then Mary also calls, then you really, really believe it, a little more than before. That's how your plausible reasoning works. Can you capture that in propositional logic? No. If it is true, it's already true. Okay? Another question is, you now also hear on the TV that there's an earthquake as these calls are flowing in. So first you heard John called, so you now think maybe there is a burglary. But Mary calls, you think, boy, there's a really, really a burglary. Then, you just look that side and the TV is going up and they're showing, all the CNN helicopters, and there's an earthquake just happened. Now you say, there's no burglary. Can you do this in logic? In fact, we'll point out in a minute that the propositional logic that you have seen till now has this property called monotonicity. What monotonicity does is, if on day one you had KB 1 and that entailed alpha, and then on day two you did KB 2, which is KB 1 plus a bunch of other stuff, extra stuff that you learned, it should still entail alpha. There's no way of not entailing alpha. If you couldn't, previously, the following is, so if you entailed alpha, if you were able to prove alpha yesterday, you will be able to prove alpha today. If on the other hand, it didn't entail beta yesterday, it may entail beta today because you know more. Logic is monotonic. The logics that you have seen till now are monotonic in the sense the number of theorems monotonically increases. The proved theorems monotonically increases. You never unprove anything. And this just comes out of what you learned till now. But for this to happen, which you agree is more like your reasoning, you need to unprove theorems. Previously you thought burglary actually occurred. As soon as an extra fact was thrown in, you now no longer believe that burglary occurred. Okay? These are things that propositional logic is unable to do. And to the extent you want to deal with real Pearl, living in real Los Angeles, you need a different kind of a logic other than just propositional logic for knowledge representation. Okay? Now, how do I handle real Pearl? Okay? how can I handle it? One is the eager way, which is, what do you mean propositional logic is not enough? I will make it be enough. I will model everything. Okay, so you want this, I'll just add these also as sentences to the knowledge base. Okay, so for example, a model basically exactly the conditions under which John will call. Model exactly the conditions under which Mary would call. You know, so for example, to write the real conditions under which John will call, you have to write things like he shouldn't be listening to loud music, he hasn't gone on an errand, he didn't recently have a tiff with Pearl. All these things have to be thrown in to make it a correct sentence, right? So A and C1 and C2 and C3 etc. up to CN, then J. Alarm goes off and all these exceptions don't hold, and you actually wrote down all the exceptions, then J. Okay, so you wake up in the morning, you know, you take your shower, or some of you don't, and then you get into the car and try to start the car, those of you who have a car, okay, thinking car will start. I would say that's a stupid thing to do. Car may not start for all sorts of reasons. Just because you put your key in, why should the car start? Maybe there's no gas, maybe there's no car, right? Maybe there's no windshield, there's no, you know, steering wheel. All of these probably you should check before starting the car, but that's not enough. What if there is a potato in the tailpipe? If you don't like somebody, you go put a nice big size russet potato in the tailpipe, and then the car tries to start and sputters and stops. If you really don't like them, put sugar in their, you know, gasoline. Especially gasoline is costlier than sugar these days, so could do that. But anyway, so the point is, you do this and the car won't start. So a truly rational person, before they start the car, should check if there are any potatoes hanging around in the tailpipe. Imagine you doing that. All your neighbors will stand looking at the spectacle. My God, this guy is such a paranoid guy. You know, do you understand what I'm saying? So there are all these exceptions, and if you waste your time checking to see whether those exceptions hold, then you will actually never do anything. Real world is so complex that if you actually check every possible exception, you won't do anything. And you will provide a lot of entertainment to those people who could do something, but now since they are watching you, they also won't do anything, right? But so the world will come to a standstill, right? And what's more interesting is, I like this, you know, not only are there exceptions, the exceptions themselves can have exceptions. Right? That's the way the real world works. So A and C1 and C2 etc. up to CN implies J, but if C1 and C5 is true, then C9 is no longer true. And you know, those of you who watched, any of you watch Brazil the movie? Okay, so do you remember this woman who says, my complications started having complications, right? That's what is happening. My complications now have their own complications. Okay, all of these problems will basically stop you from being able to model the world. And furthermore, even if you somehow model the world, imagine the size of each of these sentences. And if you have a little, you know, robot with, you know, a cheap Windows machine, it doesn't have the space to even store this stuff. And forget about ants, they can't do anything. And yet ants are getting by in a complex world. How are they doing it? And you too are getting by in a complex world, and you are, you know, better than ants, but not particularly so. Right? And how are we able to do? Because we don't waste our time trying to do this. And if anybody is doing it, we yell at them saying, don't be so paranoid. And then real paranoids have these bumper stickers saying the opposite, right? That, you know, just because you are not paranoid doesn't mean they are not out to get you. So they still would not do anything. But overall, we want to make sure that we will be able to do reasoning without completely modeling the world. Okay? It's a feature, not a bug, to be able to model worlds at a low resolution. Because if you cannot, then we, with our small brains, can't possibly deal with this world. Okay? So, by the way, this stuff, all these qualifications that I'm adding, that's called the qualification problem. So for any real world, for any action to actually take place, there are so many preconditions that should hold that you will never be able to write them all down. And the equivalent of it for the effects is the ramification problem. In any real world, one small thing can change so many other things that you can't possibly write down all the consequences of all the things you did. Otherwise, we won't be in this financial mess we are in. Right? If we all knew exactly what's going to happen if we start doing subprime loans, then we wouldn't have done them. I mean, you and I, you know, obviously, don't have any money, but the guys who are doing it wouldn't have done them. Okay? The ramification problem essentially says there's just too many things that can be the ramifications of what I'm doing. I can only at least be, I probably only be able to model some of them. Because of the qualification and ramification problem, you need to be able to deal with real world. I essentially have to be able to design languages that allow agents to be ignorant, that means non-omniscient, and lazy. That's important. Laziness is a feature, not a bug. You know, I want to be able to be lazy. Even if I have a very big computer, why, you know, fill it up with all sorts of information? And most of our brains are, in fact, you know, I think somebody, you know, pointed out, I think Louis Wanan points out that the most underutilized resource in the universe is the human brain. And that's why he finds these ways to, you know, make you do other things, such as, you know, getting images to be labeled, you know, using the extra CPU cycles that you're not using. Okay, so we want to be lazy, right? And we want a language that allows us to be lazy. Okay, so what you sort of need to do is write knowledge that is default. That is sort of true most of the time, but if it goes wrong, don't yell at me. The whole point of potato in the tailpipe problem is you would be laughed at if you kept checking your car for potatoes every morning. But at the same time, you'll also be laughed at if after 15,985 times of starting the car and letting it sputter to a halt, you still would not come and check for what's wrong with the car. Now that would be like Homer Simpson, you know, trying to do things and, you know, trying it multiple times to see if the next time it will avoid a big injury, right? So you want to be able to explain after it happens, but you don't necessarily want to model it upfront. Okay? And so how do we do this? That's basically, we have convinced ourselves that propositional logic isn't enough because we want to do all this. And how do we do it? We have three ideas, two of which I will describe in one slide each. And the third one I'll describe it in the next 4 weeks. So you know which one I like more. Okay? But let's see all the ideas. Okay? One is called non-monotonic logic. In non-monotonic logic, essentially you want to make the logic not be monotonic. This is a bug right now because you want to be able to undo inferences that you did. Okay? So you want to be able to write sentences of the form. You want to be able to write the sentence of the form. If something is a bird and it's not an abnormal bird, then it flies. So by default, birds fly. And then I say Tweety is a bird, you're supposed to, if you don't know enough about, you know, Tweety the bird from the Warner Brothers cartoon, you're supposed to believe that Tweety would be flying. Then when I say Tweety is a cartoon bird, then you are supposed to say, who the heck knows, you know, cartoon birds may or may not fly. Then I say Tweety is a magical cartoon bird, then you are supposed to say, oh, maybe it would fly again. And then I'll say Tweety is a magical cartoon bird who just had an injury, so maybe it's not flying. But it has also magic for, you know, curing itself of all injuries, so it's flying again. So make up your mind. But you're not supposed to make up your mind. In fact, we laugh at Bush because he made up his mind and didn't change it, while the ground evidence kept changing. Okay? There's a difference between flip-flopping can actually be a feature rather than a bug. Okay, what you just did, and I told you this stuff, you are flip-flopping between Tweety is flying or not flying. And you can decide and make a metaphysical statement saying, I'm going to come to my conclusion irrespective of what you say from now onwards until I get out of office. That's a problem. Okay? So you would be able to write essentially default rules, and then you need to talk about inferences over these default rules. And you need to talk about semantics for these inferences. Semantics for these inferences. So one interesting question, of course, is obviously if I bird and abnormal, and obviously if I write sentences for every possible way something can become abnormal, then it's again a monotonic logic. The basic point is abnormal is a special kind of a special proposition. What I will do is, if you are unable to prove abnormality with what you know, then you go ahead and assume that not abnormal is true. Okay? This actually is what is done in Prologue, by the way. It's called negation as failure. And it's a huge slippery slope. It's a huge slippery slope. Just because your limited mind cannot prove something doesn't mean that the negation of it is true. Right? Imagine, I mean, until like 1996, we should have then assumed that Fermat's last theorem was Fermat's last non-theorem, because none of us were able to prove it. Do you understand what I'm saying? And you still had to, and in fact, even 96, when Andrew Wiles first came up with the quote-unquote proof, it was non-proof. And so you would again say, this only increases my belief that it's a non-proof, non-theorem. And you had to, you cannot say that. Okay? So the idea is that, in normally you can't say it, but if you want to do default reasoning, you need to use abnormality as basically these kinds of things as, let's say, negation as failure. So your inability to prove something, one idea is negation as failure, your inability to prove something means the opposite is actually true. Okay? So bird and not abnormal implies fly, and if you're unable to prove to yourself that the bird is abnormal, then assume not abnormal is true. Then you get to use this rule. This is what Prologue does. Okay? And so in fact Prologue can do this kind of default reasoning. The trick, of course, is how to make sure that you can provide sound semantics for this kind of reasoning. Okay? If you are interested in this, then you should take courses with Chitta Baral or Juhing Lee, both of who do great work in essentially representing world knowledge in non-monotonic logic, default reasoning. Okay? And in non-monotonic reasoning, as you know, as I pointed out, as new evidence comes, you keep changing the theorem. A theorem that's proved can become disproved. So for example, bird and not abnormal implies fly. So if you just had that in the knowledge base, Prologue would not be able to prove abnormal. And so it assumes not abnormal is true. And so it will say it is flying. Now if I add a sentence saying, the bird that I have is abnormal. Basically, a bird is, ostrich. And ostriches are abnormal birds. I don't know, they don't like being called abnormal. They think they are the normal birds, the rest are abnormal. But, they are abnormal birds as far as we are concerned. And so you throw that in, now suddenly you are able to prove the abnormality of this bird, which means not abnormal is actually false, which means you can't use this sentence. So that means fly is no longer a theorem. Okay? This is non-monotonic logic, and you can do it for first order as well as propositional logic, and it's a very interesting direction. And one general idea that people have in this is that this abnormality somehow should be minimized. You should reduce the number of things that are abnormal. Because if you assume everything is abnormal, then you can't actually prove anything. Okay? So the way the theorems, the semantics are provided is they minimize certain predicates. So minimize the models certain predicates will have. And then try to show what are entailed, what are not entailed. That's non-monotonic logic. Okay? This is a respectable direction. We won't talk about it in this class because we have to pick some things and go with it. Okay? And you should definitely deal with, talk to Juhyung or Chitta if you're interested in this direction. They give courses every year on this stuff. The other is certainty factors. Okay? What you basically try to do is throw in a bunch of numbers along with each of the facts that you know. At first, when people started trying, looking at probabilistic reasoning, this kind of reasoning, you know, basically they started trying these kinds of ideas. So for each particular fact, or an axiom, you give a number, presumably saying that degree to which that fact or axiom is true. Some sort of a degree of truth idea. Okay? And then presumably what they are trying to do is when you give a proof, then you will be able to give a weight to the proof. Okay? So the seductive power of this idea is that it says you can do just what you were doing before. Just do the normal propositional logic. And I have these annotations, these numbers, and I'll do some arithmetic after you're done. Looks like you don't need to learn anything new. Pretty darn good. Okay? Now the problem is, this is a hugely misleading direction because I can, for example, get into cycles and not realize it. In particular, there could be causal as well as diagnostic directions in the real world. Something causes something, okay, and something is caused by something. That's the diagnostic direction. And you may know facts. So for example, if you have flu, you will get cold with some certainty, 0.9, let's say. I mean, if you have flu, you have runny nose. You will have runny nose with 0.9 certainty. If you have runny nose, you have flu with 0.4 certainty. Now I can use this in a nice little loop. Okay, some guy comes and I say, well, because you have flu, then you have runny nose. But because you have runny nose, you have even more flu. Because you have flu, you have even more runny nose. Now get out of my office because it's a flood here. Right? And so the point we're trying to do is, how do I stop this kind of cyclic reasoning? You can't possibly believe that cyclic reasoning makes sense. Okay, the reason this happens in logic is in the normal logic, we do not differentiate at all between causal and diagnostic directions. A implies B is not equal to A causes B. A implies B only is equal to not A or B. That's it. There is no more metaphysical annotations you are doing when I say A implies B. When we say it in English, we tend to assume there is a causation. A is kind of causing B. But logic doesn't believe that. When you write A implies B, it's just either not A is true or B is true. That's all you're saying. So certainty factors will get you certainly some far, some distance. But at some point of time, you will fall on your face because you get into cycles. In fact, in the original expert systems, for medicine, in fact, the guy who did one of the first expert systems, which, you know, take a domain and write what you know and do logical reasoning over it, was Ted Shotliff, who is currently a professor in, you know, School of Computing and Informatics. He sits, you know, down in downtown Phoenix. Okay, he wrote the first expert system called MySim, which mostly did logical reasoning. Then he threw in certainty factors. And it was able to do a little more because in medicine everything is sort of uncertain, so he was able to go farther, but not anywhere near good diagnosis that will rival that of human doctors. And at some point of time, people realized there is all these semantic problems here. This one, there is no semantic problem. It's just that if you ask me, my biased opinion is that it's too hard to do it right now. There's nothing wrong with it right now, but it's just computationally it's too hard to do it. Okay? This one is a dodo idea. You should know what is a dodo idea so that you won't reinvent it. Okay? And so we will get to probabilistic reasoning. Okay? And all we will do is basically say that if I have a bunch of variables, all these propositions are variables, they are random variables, I will provide a joint distribution for those random variables. And if I provide a joint distribution, then every possible query you want to ask can be captured. Okay? In particular, we'll talk about how to do this in an efficient fashion. And since we are ending the class, I want to throw this kind of picture. This is the guy, Pearl, that I've been talking about all this while, okay, in the example. This is Uriah Pearl. And the reason you might have heard the Pearl name is what? In news. Danny Pearl. Danny Pearl is Uriah Pearl's son. Okay, so combining real world and our world. Okay, Hoodia Pearl is, you know, one of these days is going to get a Turing Award because he's done great, great work both in search and heuristics, and also in Bayes networks, which is basically reasoning with probability in efficient fashion. Okay, we'll come back next week and get into probabilistic reasoning.